I do not have the tools to give you to carry out the task as it should be. You will establish your headquarters in Auckland, New Zealand, with an advanced base at Tonga Tabu. In time, possibly this fall, we hope to start an offensive in the South Pacific. You will then probably find it necessary to shift the advanced base, as the situation demands, and move your own headquarters to meet special situations. I would like for you to leave Washington in 1 week, if possible. Admiral Garmley, 59, had served in destroyers and battleships, followed by multiple staff assignments, culminating in a stint as chief of the War Plans Division in 1938-39, in which he earned a reputation as a brilliant strategist. Considered by King to be a very able man, Garmley was highly respected for his intelligence and well-liked by his subordinates. Even so, many shared the opinion of Marine Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Griffith, who later wrote, "It is not entirely clear what prompted King to this appointment. While one cannot rise to flag rank without some sense of politics, and indeed, there has been some suggestion that Roosevelt, a fan of Garmley's, may have interceded on his behalf, Garmley seems to have been shy and introverted, especially among peers. An outgoing personality is not needed to be an outstanding commander or a capable administrator, but Garmley's previous positions never required the proactivity he would need now. They had required diplomacy, however, and so would this new assignment. And Admiral Garmley did have considerable diplomatic skills. He arrived in Noumea, New Caledonia, on May 17th, to find Admiral Georges-Thierry d'Argenlieu, who had taken the island for the Free French, unhappy that he and his commander-in-chief, Charles de Gaulle, had not been consulted on Pacific strategy. But Garmley managed to smooth things over, and then flew to New Zealand. Of his first impressions of the area, Garmley wrote, "The vast distances, the shortage of aircraft, the ease with which the Japanese could slip between defended points, the large size of many islands, the high mountains on most of them, the primitive state of the natives, the total lack of harbor or base facilities, the lack of cable facilities, the lack of ships." Grim first impressions did not count for much in Admiral King's planning. On April 16th, King's Assistant Chief of Staff for Planning, Rear Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner, presented a four-phase Pacific Ocean campaign plan. Phase one was the buildup of forces and bases in the South Pacific to secure the area and position for an offensive against the Japanese. Phase two was an offensive up through the Solomons and New Guinea to seize the Bismarck and Admiralty Islands. Phase three would extend that offensive to the Central Pacific, such as the Marshall and especially the Caroline Islands. Phase four would involve a drive into the Philippines or the Netherlands East Indies, whichever offers the more promising and enduring results. This document would become the basic plan for the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. To make this plan work, earlier Admiral Turner had also recommended the establishment of an amphibious assault force in the South Pacific. King agreed and ordered Admiral Nimitz to create it. When Nimitz arrived back in Hawaii after his April 23rd to 24th conference with Admiral King in San Francisco, he was carrying the specific directive to Admiral Garmley to prepare to launch a major amphibious offensive against positions held by the Japanese. The Pacific Fleet staff conducted studies that examined the Santa Cruz and Lower Solomon Islands. King made Turner commander of this new amphibious force. Turner, very uncharacteristically, admitted that he knew little of the subject. King responded, "Kelly, you will learn." It was a new war, with new weapons, new tactics, and new ways of thinking. How this all interacted, no one knew. They would have to learn on the fly, something that American officers would later call Mickey Learney. Like King and Nimitz, Admiral Turner, who went by Kelly, would leave his sizable and controversial imprint on the Pacific War. Thin, 57 years old, he looked like a college professor, with the intellect, the vision, and the patronizing manner to match. A trained aviator, Turner would be described by eminent naval aviation historian John Lundstrom as a tough, bright, even brilliant officer. Terrible Turner was also arrogant, abrasive, irascible, and domineering, grasping for power where he had no business. Only strong-willed commanders kept him in check. Nimitz remarked that Turner was like King and that he was brilliant, caustic, arrogant, and tactless, just the man for the job. Then Lieutenant Colonel Merrill B. Twining, operations officer of the 1st Marine Division, later worked extensively with Turner and remembered him as having a colossal ego that sometimes led to decisions that ignored the dictates of ordinary common sense. Twining meant it with all due respect, as he did the following description of Turner, a loud, strident, arrogant person who enjoyed settling all matters by simply raising his voice and roaring like a bull captain in the old Navy. His peers understood this and accepted it with amused resignation because they valued him for what he was, a good and determined leader with a fine mind when he chose to use it. While Admiral Turner got to work building the South Pacific Amphibious Force from scratch, Marine Major General Alexander Archer Vandegrift was busy training the 1st Marine Division in New Zealand. In March, Vandegrift had been ordered to prepare a regiment to be sent to Samoa. Suspecting the regiment would see combat, Vandegrift cannibalized the rest of the 1st Marine Division to pack the 7th Marine Regiment with as many of the most experienced officers and non-commissioned officers as possible, and the 7th was shipped off. The general's suspicions would have been correct if Midway had resulted in defeat, but it didn't. On April 15th, General Vandegrift was ordered to move the 1st Marine Division, without the 7th Marine Regiment, to New Zealand to form the new landing force of the South Pacific Amphibious Force, which was expected to be seeing combat soon. So right after he assembled his most combat-ready men to send to a place where they would see no combat, the general was now to get the rest of his division, the 1st, 5th, and 11th Marine Regiments, all green, ready for combat. Vandegrift got to work trying to very quickly mold these green recruits into a fighting force. The Japanese were pushing ahead with their next offensive, the capture of Tulagi in the Solomons and Port Moresby, the only remaining position of value in Allied hands in New Guinea. Always keeping his eye out for opportunities to attack, Nimitz believed the Tulagi position was exposed and proposed raiding it using the 1st Marine Raider Battalion. This started another tug-of-war between General MacArthur, who, though he would shortly field slightly more than three divisions, admitted he did not have the forces to take Tulagi, and Admiral King, who thought Tulagi was too small and wanted something more. And there things sat, while carrier battles took place in the Coral Sea, in which the Japanese invasion force directed at Port Moresby was turned back, and near Midway, in which four Japanese carriers were sunk. Despite the losses of the carriers Lexington and Yorktown, destroyers Sims and Hammond, and oiler Neosho, the positive effects of both actions, especially Midway, on sagging American morale cannot be overstated. But the American victory at Midway would not have been possible without magic. Magic was a subset of what is more commonly and famously known as ULTRA, the term adopted by the Allies to reference signals intelligence, in military acronym SIGINT, obtained by breaking encrypted enemy radio and wireless telegraph communications. While ULTRA covered all such intelligence, the U.S. adopted the term MAGIC for its decrypts specifically from Japanese sources. In the case of Coral Sea and Midway, a breakthrough had come in the Japanese Naval High-Level Command and Control Communications Code the Allies called JN-25. The Allied breakthrough had been the result of painstaking intelligence work. With the Japanese unaware of the breach, magic and signals intelligence would be the gift that kept on giving. As it was, Midway was its own gift, of which some could not wait to take advantage. The Yorktown was perhaps still on her way to the bottom of the Pacific when, on June 8th, General MacArthur told Washington he could overrun New Britain and New Ireland in a few weeks, that important area forcing the enemy back 700 miles to his base at Truk, thus obtaining manifold strategic advantages, both defensive and offensive. All he would need to do this were only the three infantry divisions he already had, which earlier had not been enough to seize Tulagi, plus one division trained and completely equipped for amphibious operations, and a task force including two carriers. That sounded fine to General Marshall, who believed this potential operation needed to be run as quickly as possible. He was in the process of requesting the necessary forces from Admiral King, when King preempted MacArthur's proposal with one of his own. The Navy was already preparing operations against the objectives MacArthur mentioned, operations that would be more gradual. Capture of intermediate air bases was necessary to help neutralize the air power based at Rabaul. Such a campaign would be primarily of a naval and amphibious character, supported and followed by forces operating from Australia, In short, the Navy would do it, with MacArthur's help. Admiral King was continuing to lay the groundwork for offensive operations in the Solomons. On June 11th, King asked Admiral Garmley when he could go on the attack. Garmley replied that he planned to occupy the New Hebrides, Santa Cruz, and Ellis Islands, which were unoccupied, as soon as the prospect of reinforcement is favorable. This did not answer the question. It was a sign of things to come. But General MacArthur did try to answer the questions posed to him, or at least obfuscate them. In a June 24th message, MacArthur addressed the criticism of his plan by claiming his original proposal was only an outline. Quite obviously, he said, a gradual approach with seizure of intermediate bases in the Solomons and New Guinea would be required to capture Roubaix. What MacArthur meant by gradual, he did not say, but plans at his headquarters indicated his version of gradual was 14 to 18 days. He would not need any more time. He spent the rest of the message explaining why only he, Douglas MacArthur, should be in command of this offensive. Correctly figuring MacArthur was blackmailing the U.S. Navy into greater reinforcements in the South Pacific, Admiral King was having none of it. He tried to explain to MacArthur that Tulagi had to be taken before Roubaix, or else the air power based there posed too great a risk to his ships. That same day, King ordered Nimitz to prepare a plan to capture Tulagi and adjacent islands. The next day, King told General Marshall they needed to strike now, before this golden opportunity arising out of Midway passed. The Admiral recommended a single unified command to perform the seizure of the Santa Cruz Islands as the start of an offensive to begin around August 1st that would culminate in the capture of New Guinea and Roubaix. The day after that came General Marshall's response. He continued to push for General MacArthur's command, mainly on the grounds that the operation lay almost entirely in the Southwest Pacific area and that it was designed to add to the security of that area, though he did acknowledge that the boundaries were not necessarily controlling. He went on to make the case, such as it was, for General MacArthur to lead this offensive through the Solomon Islands and New Guinea to Roubaix and New Britain. By now well aware that he was in a political pissing contest, Admiral King responded in writing the same day. General Marshall's basic trouble, he later said, was that like all Army officers, he knew nothing about sea power and very little about air power. So, King later explained, he had to educate the Army people. King told Marshall that he had agreed to have an Army general in command of the European theater, unity of command, because it would be fought primarily by the Army. The Pacific was being fought primarily by the Navy and Marine Corps, hence it made more sense to have a Navy admiral in charge. The offensive must be conducted under the direction of SINCPAC and cannot be conducted in any other way. He finally said he was going to start an offensive, even if no support of Army forces in the Southwest Pacific is available. King gave Admiral Nimitz orders to this effect on June 27th. General Marshall was furious. Without approval from President Roosevelt or the Joint Chiefs, Admiral King had ordered preparation for a major offensive into General MacArthur's Southwest Pacific area. He also seemed to be defying Roosevelt's order not to reinforce the Pacific. Once Admiral Nimitz started his attack, reinforcements would be forthcoming. But King could point to Roosevelt's approval of his March 2nd memorandum for limited actions in the Solomons, and he had only ordered Nimitz to prepare for an offensive. MacArthur was beyond furious. He had not even seen Admiral King's letter to Marshall. He had just picked up King's orders to Admiral Nimitz, and Nimitz's response, in which he listed some units under MacArthur's command for the attack. In one of his more remarkable tantrums of the war, in the words of the historian Richard B. Frank, MacArthur on June 28th radioed General Marshall, "It is quite evident, in reviewing the whole situation, that the Navy contemplates assuming general command control of all operations in the Pacific theater, the role of the Army being subsidiary, and consisting largely of placing its forces at the disposal and under the command of Navy or Marine officers. I shall take no steps or action with reference to any components of my command except under your direct orders." Evidently, MacArthur thought it was patently ridiculous that an invasion of Pacific islands across thousands of miles of ocean be commanded by someone from the Navy, especially when it could be commanded by Douglas MacArthur. But it was about more than that, the general alleged. It was all part of a master plan for the complete absorption of the National Defense Function by the Navy, a plan he had accidentally uncovered when he was Chief of Staff of the Army. By using Army troops to garrison the islands of the Pacific under Navy command, the Navy retains Marine forces always available, giving them inherently an army of their own, and serving as the real bases of their plans by virtue of having the most readily available units for offensive action. General Marshall, of course, backed his Army colleague. But even he admitted that General MacArthur was super sensitive about everything, and thought everybody had ulterior motives about everything. MacArthur's hypersensitivity was something of a joke in defense circles. His paranoia, lust for personal publicity, political ambition, structured and comfortable lifestyle, and hypochondria were well known in the Army. His emotional balance was precarious. These personal foibles made George Patton look normal. It was left to General Marshall, after he had sufficiently calmed down himself, to initiate a way out of the impasse. During the last 2 days of June, Marshall and Admiral King hammered out the Joint Directive for Offensive Operations in the Southwest Pacific Area, agreed on by the United States Chiefs of Staff, that consisted of three phases. Phase 1, already given its own codename of Watchtower, would involve the seizure of Tulagi and the Santa Cruz Islands. This task would be completed by the Pacific Fleet. MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command boundary would be moved up the Solomons, so this phase would lie entirely within the South Pacific Command. MacArthur himself would interdict enemy air and naval activities westward of operating area, meaning Rabaul and New Guinea. Phase 2 would be the capture of Lae, Salamaua, the rest of the northeast coast of New Guinea, and the central Solomons. Phase 3 would involve the reduction and capture of Rabaul. Phases 2 and 3 would be under the command of General MacArthur. This three-part plan was given the cheerful name of Pestilence. Admiral King and General Marshall, curiously not General Arnold, formally adopted Pestilence on July 2nd. Phase 1, Watchtower, involving the capture of the Santa Cruz Islands, Tulagi, and adjacent positions, was scheduled to begin August 1st. King scheduled a meeting with Admiral Nimitz for July 3rd in San Francisco to brief him on these developments. In the interim, Nimitz had been working on Watchtower as he understood it. On June 27th, he expanded the planned attack on Tulagi to include the capture of an unspecified airfield site, if not a finished airfield. On July 2nd, Admiral Turner briefed Nimitz on how Watchtower was developing. In what he called a limited amphibious offensive in South and Southwest Pacific, Turner planned to capture various islands to create a web of mutually supporting airfields. His first target would be Undaney in the Santa Cruz Islands, some 250 miles north of Espiritu Santo in the New Hebrides, where Admiral Nimitz had already authorized development of a base, and 350 miles southeast of Tulagi. Turner thought Undaney would make a great airbase to guard the eastern flank of the Solomons, largely because he had never been there and knew nothing about it. But as Admiral King had said earlier, he would learn. Next would be the Tulagi and Florida Islands. The problem was that there was no place on either island to build an airfield, so Admiral Turner suggested a coastal plain on Guadalcanal, 18 miles to the south, where an airfield could be built. Neither he nor Admiral Nimitz had any idea as yet that more than a few parties were suddenly interested in Guadalcanal. Among those parties was, like magic, a uniquely useful form of Allied intelligence gathering in the South Pacific, an organization called Ferdinand, named after the children's story Ferdinand the Bull, whose title character preferred smelling flowers to fighting. Ferdinand was the brainchild of Australian naval reservist, Lieutenant Commander Eric A. Felt, a veteran of the British Grand Fleet in World War I. Felt had been local affairs administrator on New Guinea, where he became familiar with the talented, temperamental, and fiercely independent Melanesian natives. When Felt was recalled to service, he came up with the idea of enrolling plantation managers, government administrators, missionaries, and anyone who wanted to serve but not to fight, not to be noticed, not to cause any trouble for the Japanese, except to watch and warn of Japanese movements, actions, and other developments. By December 1939, Ferdinand had 800 members, located everywhere in New Guinea, the Bismarcks, and the Solomons, including chief observers trained to communicate by radio. they would become known as Coast Watchers. Upon the arrival of the Japanese, the Coast Watchers became dependent on the goodwill of the local Melanesians, whether due to the respect and humanity with which the Australian local colonial officials had treated them, the general brutality with which the Japanese treated everybody, including them, or both, the vast majority of Melanesians remained loyal to the Allied cause. They became essential to the Allies by gathering information, carrying equipment and supplies, providing cover, and infiltrating Japanese construction details. As the Japanese advanced and began consolidating their hold on the Solomons, the Coast Watchers, directed from Townsville, Australia, became eyes and ears, but not hands, for the Allies. Six in particular became critical to the South Pacific War effort. In a hilltop hideout in Porapora, northern Bougainville, near the Buka Passage, where the local Melanesians had, unlike the others, switched sides to the Japanese, was Lieutenant W.J. Jack Reed. At the other end of Bougainville, overlooking the Shortland Islands, was Paul Mason, a short, bespectacled radio hobbyist and former plantation manager with 25 years' experience in the islands. At a plantation on Seagy Point on New Georgia was Donald Kennedy, a middle-aged former district officer who, according to Felt, projected a natural aura of command. Guadalcanal had three coast-watching posts. On Gold Ridge, 15 miles from the coast, was naval reservist Donald McFarlane, working with Kenneth D. Hay, a sizable plantation manager with sizable intelligence. On western Guadalcanal was F. Ashton Snowy Rhodes, working with an older former Norwegian trader, Leif Fruda. Filling the role of chief coast watcher on Guadalcanal was former district officer Martin Clemens, positioned east of Lunga at Aola Bay. It was Martin Clemens who first noticed Japanese activity in the Lunga area. By radio and by native runner, he, McFarlane, Hay, and Rhodes compared notes to determine what the Japanese were doing. When the convoy carrying the 11th and 13th construction units arrived, they deduced the Japanese were building an airfield. Construction on the base progressed under the watchful and thoroughly enraged eyes of Martin Clemens. As a result of the work of Clemens and friends, Ferdinand reported work at the Lunga site on July 1st. Ferdinand was joined the next day by Magic, who concluded the Japanese had landed construction troops on Guadalcanal. Admiral Nimitz had wanted to seize an airfield site. Now he had one. King and Nimitz agreed to replace Andaini in Phase 1 with Guadalcanal for the time being. But that airfield construction was an hourglass, and as it got closer to completion, the sand was running out. In the midst of all this politicking, Admiral Garmley was dealing with a South Pacific command that was little more than a paper and a cabin on the command ship Argonne, given the happy nickname Agony Maru, in Auckland. On June 25th, he had been ordered to arrange the capture of Tulagi and adjacent positions. Garmley was flabbergasted. His immediate mental estimate of the situation was that they were far from ready to start any offensive. And they weren't. At the moment, all Garmley had was a tiny staff that was largely scavenged from the Asiatic fleet, with Rear Admiral Daniel J. Callaghan, former skipper of the cruiser San Francisco and formerly President Roosevelt's naval aide, as its chief. Garmley had little information, no major units under his command, and no bases anywhere close to the target. Nimitz was trying to help with that by directing the seizure of Espiritu Santo, 125 miles north of Efate in the New Hebrides, where an airfield was to be constructed. But in a pattern that would reveal itself more and more over the coming months, Garmley actually complicated his own reinforcement when he refused to shift troops from rear bases to Espiritu Santo, without which Nimitz would not authorize the airfield. Ultimately, just to get going, on July 3rd, Nimitz ordered construction of the airstrip, on the next day specifying that it be made ready for B-17s by July 28th. The arrival of the new orders from Admiral King for the seizure of Guadalcanal and Tulagi before the issuance of the Joint Chiefs directive had done nothing to improve Admiral Garmley's sinking mood. General Vandegrift had come from his own headquarters in Wellington to pay his new superior an official call in Auckland on June 26th when he was summoned to meet the Admiral. Vandegrift had met Garmley in Washington and was surprised at his harassed, almost brusque manner now. They had barely shaken hands when Admiral Garmley declared, "Vandegrift, I have some very disconcerting news." "I'm sorry to hear that, Admiral. You will be more sorry when you read this, Garmley said as he handed the Marine General a piece of paper. Vandegrift pulled a chair up to the Admiral's desk to read it. It was a set of top-secret orders. General Vandegrift's 1st Marine Division was to seize Guadalcanal and Tulagi as part of an amphibious operation. Vandegrift had to read it again to be sure of the shocking words they contained. The most shocking was the date, August 1st. General Vandegrift folded the orders and silently pushed them across the desk to Admiral Garmley. Then the general leaned back in his chair. He had to think. The admiral tapped the orders with his index finger for a moment, then looked at Vandegrift. Well? General Vandegrift went over his issues. He had been given command of the 1st Marine Division, but it came with the disclaimer, some assembly required. The 7th Marine Regiment was garrisoning Samoa. The divisional command and the 5th Marine Regiment were in Wellington, New Zealand. The 1st and the 11th Marine Regiments, the latter less two of its battalions, were en route. To compound matters, they had to break in new equipment, and their supply situation had to be determined. Most importantly, they needed information on Guadalcanal. Vandegrift didn't even know where Guadalcanal was. The general concluded, I don't see how we can land anywhere by August 1st. I don't see how we can land at all, and I am going to take it up with MacArthur, Garmley responded. Meanwhile, we'll have to go ahead as best we can. And with that inspiring declaration, the meeting was concluded. A rather subtle but important distinction had been exposed. General Vandegrift thought Watchtower could not be started by August 1st. Admiral Garmley thought it could not be started at all. Admiral King, with his belief in making the best of what you have, was conscious of the difference. General Vandegrift had to redouble his work. He tried to arrange to assemble his division as quickly as possible, at sea if necessary. His staff informed him that to replace the 7th Marine Regiment, which was staying at Samoa for the time being, they were getting the 2nd Marine Regiment from the 2nd Marine Division. The catch was that the 2nd was sailing in from San Diego. They were getting the 1st Raider Battalion back from the 7th Marine Regiment, but it was still in Samoa. They were also getting the 3rd Defense Battalion sailing in from Hawaii. But the general had to assemble more than just his division. Admiral Turner would be commander of the amphibious force, but he would not arrive until mid-July, so Vandegrift had to draw up the plan for the landing and the amphibious force himself. He had to assemble his supplies for the cargo ships and transports. Combat loading, it was called. Upon landing, the most essential supplies, such as ammunition, food, water, fuel, and medical supplies, would be positioned to be unloaded first. Less essential supplies, such as accordions, shoe polish, and hats, would be at the back of the supply queue. With the dock workers at Wellington trying to heist the government for more money, the 5th Marine Regiment had to take up the loading arrangements itself, in the midst of heavy rains that lasted for some 3 weeks. With the two most important elements in any combat operation being communications and information, General Vandegrift gave Lieutenant Colonel Frank B. Getke, 1st Marine Division's intelligence officer and former football star at Ohio State, the task of redressing the distressing lack of the latter. Getke and his section interviewed former Solomons residents, civil servants, and merchant ships officers in New Zealand. On July 1st, Getke even flew to Melbourne, where he spent a week scouring General MacArthur's headquarters for everything he could get on Guadalcanal. He found out about the Ferdinand organization and was able to establish contact. Getke then spent a few days in Sydney, continuing to dredge up and interview former residents of the Solomons. Soon Guadalcanal got its code name, a name that would become famous, Cactus. Other locations got code names as well. Tulagi was Ringbolt, Espiritu Santo, Button, New Zealand, Spooner, and Afati, Roses. The orders for pestilence included a directive that Admiral Garmley meet with General MacArthur to coordinate planning. The South Pacific commander went to Melbourne on July 8th, but he wasn't happy about it. He informed MacArthur's command, on account of early commencement of Phase 1, and the great detail of planning necessary, I will be accompanied by minimum officers, and my stay must be as short as possible. For his part, MacArthur was still brooding over not being given the entire command over the first offensive in the Pacific. Like most meetings involving Garmley, this was not going to be a happy meeting. The two announced their lack of confidence in the planning, preparation, and execution of Watchtower, now only 3 weeks away. The two commanders are of the opinion, arrived at independently, and confirmed after discussion, that the initiation of the operation at this time without a reasonable assurance of adequate air coverage would be attended with the gravest risk. Surprise is now improbable. Successful accomplishment is open to the gravest doubts. It is recommended that this operation be deferred. The issue, as they saw it, was air power, more precisely, lack of the same. The landing force would need carrier support from 36 to 96 hours, where they will be outside the range of any supporting air and exposed to continual hostile surface and submarine attacks. General MacArthur did not have the air power to sufficiently suppress that of Rabaul. The carriers will be themselves exposed to attack by land-based air while unprotected by our land-based aviation. Consequently, it was extremely doubtful that they will be able to furnish fighter escort to the transport area, especially should hostile naval forces approach. Surprise was improbable due to the depth of the existing hostile reconnaissance. Moreover, with their nearby bases, the Japanese were better positioned to rush reinforcements to the Solomons that could destroy the invasion and covering forces. The initiation of this operation at this time, without a reasonable assurance of adequate air coverage during each phase, would be attended with the gravest risk. General MacArthur and Admiral Garmley recommended Watchtower be deferred, pending the further development of force to enable all three phases of pestilence to take place in one continuous movement, which sounded suspiciously like MacArthur's proposals from early June. Admiral King saw exactly what was happening. Douglas MacArthur was sulking over not being given complete command over pestilence. Likely speaking for the naval leadership, King told General Marshall, 3 weeks ago, MacArthur stated that if he could be furnished amphibious forces and two carriers, he could push right through to Rabaul. He now feels that he not only cannot undertake this operation, but not even the Tulagi operation. With the Japanese already on Guadalcanal, the sand in that hourglass was running out. Watchtower now needed speed, not delay. Admiral King contemptuously responded to their statement with a one-word order, execute. Perhaps appropriately, the MacArthur-Gormley memo of hopeless optimism crossed one in which Admiral Nimitz told Gormley, I have full confidence in your ability to carry this operation to a successful conclusion. More appropriately, the missive got the attention of General Marshall, who tried to bolster the operation by sending the 11th Bombardment Group to the South Pacific. The first of its B-17s arrived at the newly completed airfield at Espiritu Santo on July 30th. The completion of the airfield in such a short time, especially given how the Seabees, men of the construction battalions, were fighting heat and malaria, was, said the commander of land-based air, Rear Admiral John S. Slew McCain, a truly remarkable achievement. On the opposite end of the remarkable spectrum was the situation in Wellington. The 1st Marine Division and its supplies were still straggling in. Organizing the supplies in the driving rain was still a headache, with a lack of dock space in Wellington being the major culprit, becoming a drag on the operation. To try to speed things along, General Vandegrift ordered that all units reduce their equipment and supplies to those items that are actually required to live and fight, helping earn Operation Watchtower the nickname Operation Shoestring. The supply difficulties caused Vandegrift to ask for a slight delay in Watchtower. On July 16th, the date was officially reset for August 7th, but the Japanese were so close to completing the airfield that the date could not be pushed back further. That same day, Vice Admiral Garmley published and distributed a 174-page operational plan for Watchtower. Given the catchy title of Op Plan 142, it was not a particularly complicated plan from an organizational standpoint. Under his South Pacific command were two task forces. One, Task Force 63, under Rear Admiral McCain, consisted of all the land and water-based aircraft. Everything else he placed in what he called Task Force 61, the Expeditionary Force. The Expeditionary Force was under the command of the newly promoted Vice Admiral Frank Jack Fletcher, the most experienced carrier admiral in the Navy, veteran and victor of both the Coral Sea, where he had lost one aircraft carrier, and Midway, where he had lost another aircraft carrier, and who was currently sailing from Pearl Harbor under radio silence. Identified under his direct command were six task forces. Three of them were carrier groups, each consisting of one aircraft carrier plus an escorting screen. Task Force 11, under Fletcher's direct command, was centered on his flagship carrier, Saratoga, escorted by heavy cruisers Minneapolis and New Orleans, and destroyers Phelps, Farragut, Wharton, McDonough, and Dale. Task Force 16 was commanded by Rear Admiral Thomas C. Kincaid on the carrier Enterprise, with a new battleship North Carolina, heavy cruiser Portland, light cruiser Atlanta, and destroyers Balch, Maury, Gwyn, Benham, and Grayson. The Atlanta was a new class of light cruiser, featuring 16 rapid-fire 5-inch guns and 8 dual mounts. The weapons layout would be good in air defense, and she was classified as an anti-aircraft cruiser. Task Force 18 was under Rear Admiral Lee Noyes, the only trained aviator of the three carrier admirals. His flag was on the aircraft carrier Wasp, which was the only one of the three carriers whose air group was trained in night operations. She was screened by heavy cruisers San Francisco and Salt Lake City, and destroyers Lang, Sterett, Aaron Ward, Stack, Laffey, and Fahrenhold. Providing fuel to the carrier task forces were 5 oilers, Platt, Cimarron, Kaskaskia, Sabine, and Kanawha. As a general rule, each of the American fleet carriers had an air group that consisted of 4 squadrons. Each squadron was assigned a particular role: fighting, bombing, scouting, or torpedo. Originally, the squadrons were designated according to their role and the hull number of their carrier. So, for instance, the hull number of the carrier Enterprise was 6. The fighter squadron on the Enterprise was officially designated VF-6, but was informally known as Fighting 6. Normally, carrier fighter squadrons like Fighting 6 would have 27 Grumman F-4F Wildcats, the U.S. Navy's primary fighter. The rather stubby-looking Wildcat would be the primary opponent for the famous Japanese Zero. It had a slightly lower top speed and inferior rates of climb, acceleration, and maneuverability compared to the Zero. But unlike their Japanese counterparts, pilot protection was a major priority for American combat aircraft procurement, and the Wildcat was no exception. The Wildcat was rugged, with an armored cockpit and self-sealing fuel tanks combining to provide excellent protection for the pilots. The F-4F was considered obsolete, but when flown with even moderate skill, it could more than hold its own against the Zero. The typical torpedo squadron, to use the Enterprise's original squadron as an example, had the official designation of VT-6 and was called Torpedo 6. Normally, it would have 18 of the Grumman TBF Avenger. The Avenger was a brand new torpedo plane, rushed into service because its predecessor, the Douglas TBD Devastator, was not only obsolete, but had become a death trap. At Midway, every single one of the Devastators from the carrier Hornet's Torpedo 8 had been shot down by Zeros and anti-aircraft fire. The Avenger was fast for a torpedo plane, with long range and even an enclosed bomb bay. Like its fellow Grumman Wildcat, the Avenger was a very rugged plane with good protection for the pilot. The TBF was easily recognizable by its 50-caliber dorsal tail gun. It also carried a ventral 30-caliber tail gun and a 30-caliber pea shooter for the pilot. Its enclosed bomb bay could carry 2 1,000-pound bombs, 4 500-pound bombs, or 1 torpedo. The big drawback here was that the torpedo was the Mark 13, which, like the American Mark 14 and Mark 15 torpedoes, seemed to be less than effective. To continue with the Enterprise as an example, each carrier had 2 squadrons of dive bombers, each with 18 Douglas SBD Dauntlesses. One squadron was dedicated to dive bombing, carrying the official designation VB-6 or Bombing 6. The Dauntless was also used to conduct long-range reconnaissance, which was an additional focus for originally VS-6 or Scouting 6. The Dauntless did not look like much, and its aerial ratings were not all that impressive either, but the Dauntless was the hero of Midway and beloved by its pilots. As the war went on, the numerical designations for carrier squadrons would get mixed up as carriers were lost or sidelined for repair, or carrier squadrons were rotated. For instance, the Enterprise's scout bombing squadron was now actually VS-5, Scouting 5, moved over from the sunken Yorktown, as was the Enterprise's torpedo squadron, VT-3, Torpedo 3. Admiral Turner's force, called Task Force 62, was subdivided 9 ways. The group of transports headed for Lunga was officially called Task Group 62.1, but codenamed Transport Group X-Ray. It was commanded by Captain Lawrence F. Reifsnyder, with transports Fuller, American Legion, McCauley, Barnett, George F. Elliott, Hunter Liggett, Alchiba, Crescent City, President Hayes and President Adams, and cargo ships Elhena, Beetlejuice, Bellatrix, Libra, and Fomalo. This transport group was further divided into two groups of three transports and one cargo ship each, one group of two transports and two cargo ships, and one group of two transports and one cargo ship. The distinction between transports and cargo ships might seem academic, and indeed in most reports they are both lumped together as transports, but in fact there was considerable difference. Each transport was assigned to carry one combat team, three units of fire, roughly the amount of ammunition consumed in a day of heavy combat, 30 days' rations, and quartermaster, ordnance, engineer, chemical, signal, and medical supplies. Each cargo ship was to carry supporting troops, heavy equipment, seven more units of fire, 30 days' rations and other supplies, and clothing stocks were assigned to each cargo ship. Indeed, some very important people would demonstrate they were quite conscious of the difference. Providing artillery support to the landing at Lunga was Task Group 62.3, with heavy cruisers Quincy, Vincennes, and Astoria, each cruiser with two spotter planes, and destroyers Hull, Dewey, Ellet, and Wilson, commanded by the Vincennes skipper, Captain Frederick L. Reefcole. The landing at Tulagi centered on officially Task Group 62.2, coded Transport Group Yoke, under Captain George B. Ash. Not surprisingly, given its target, it was much smaller than its Guadalcanal counterpart, consisting of transports Neville, Zeilen, Haywood, and President Jackson, and four old destroyers converted into fast, by transport standards, transports, Colquhoun, Little, McKean, and Gregory. The Tulagi landing would get fire support from the official Task Group 62.4 under Rear Admiral Norman Scott, flying his flag in the light cruiser San Juan, a designated anti-aircraft cruiser like her sister Atlanta. In addition to the San Juan, the fire support would come from the destroyers Monson and Buchanan. Task Group 62.5 was a group of minesweepers, creatively dubbed the Minesweeper Group, under Commander William H. Hart, Jr. Its job was to sweep for mines around both Tulagi, Guadalcanal, and Tsavo Sound in general with minesweepers Hopkins, Trevor, Sane, Southard, and Hovey. Given the task of providing protection from surface forces was MacArthur's Navy, the Allied ship supporting General MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command. They were normally designated Task Force 44, but for Watchtower they were called Task Group 62.6, the Screening Group. It consisted of Royal Australian Navy heavy cruisers Australia and Canberra, U.S. Navy heavy cruiser Chicago, Australian light cruiser Hobart, and American destroyers Selfridge, Patterson, Ralph Talbot, Mugford, Jarvis, Blue, Helm, Henley, and Bagley. This squadron was commanded by Rear Admiral Victor Alexander Charles Crutchley, a British admiral on loan to the Royal Australian Navy, which was such a new organization that it lacked experienced flag officers of its own. Generally, Americans did not and do not like serving under foreign officers, especially after what they considered the subpar performance of the Dutch admiral, Karel Doorman, during the Java Sea campaign. Victor Crutchley seems to have been an exception. He was a distinguished Royal Navy veteran, known for his physical courage, having fought in the Battle of Jutland, been awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for one attempt to block the German U-boat fleets in harbor, been awarded the Victoria Cross, Britain's highest award for bravery, for gallantry and seamanship during another, and on top of all that, the French Croix de Guerre, all during World War I. He commanded the battleship Warspite to an impressive victory against the German Kriegsmarine off Narvik early in World War II. His intelligence, careful demeanor, and meticulous approach to planning and operations deeply impressed his American colleagues. Because almost everything needs a numeric designation, the carrier planes supporting the landing were officially called Task Group 62.7, the Air Support Group. This would be the air support provided by the carriers Saratoga, Enterprise, and Wasp, in the form of fighter cover and bombing attacks. Fighter director officers were placed on the flagship Macaulay and the transport Neville to direct air support for Guadalcanal and Tulagi, respectively. Another fighter director officer would be placed on the cruiser Chicago to direct the intercept of the expected Japanese air attacks on transports. The direct air support for General Vandegrift's Marines was called Task Group 62.8, with floatplanes from the Astoria and Quincy spotting for the Guadalcanal landing, while those from the Vincennes would support the landing on Tulagi under Brigadier General William H. Rupertus. The Marines set to land on Santa Cruz were not given a numeric designation for some reason, though they appeared in Admiral Turner's Table of Organization. The Transport Macaulay would serve as Admiral Turner's flagship, a far more grandiose term than this ship actually deserved. Like many transports, the Macaulay was a hurried conversion from a cruise liner, in this case the Santa Barbara, who for some 12 years had carried passengers most recently for Grace Lines. Whether she carried them in luxury is open to question. Even by Navy standards, she was cramped, with staff officers crammed together, three in a room, and the more junior ship and communication officers stacked up in bunk rooms. Moreover, by the time the U.S. Navy got the Macaulay, she was a dirty ship. Not that this was unusual for the transports on this mission, as many of the Marines noticed. The American Legion was so filthy that the men on board were said to resemble wild gypsies, many choosing to sleep out on deck, so many that individual squads would protect areas on deck they had settled. It was even worse on the transport John Erickson, transporting Marines from San Francisco to Wellington, New Zealand. Navy officers had to step in to prevent the John Erickson from loading rancid butter and rotten eggs, but not the spoiled beef and chicken and fouled cooking grease that later sickened most of the men on board. Marine Corporal Grady Gallant called the food genuine slop and declared none of it was fit to eat. Marine Robert Leckie said there was not an ounce of fresh food on the ship. Even the Marine history, though not mentioning the John Erickson by name, admitted the standard of health for Marines arriving in New Zealand remained fairly high, except for troops on board one transport of the second echelon. Among those Marines, rotten food on the voyage to New Zealand had caused a loss of weight varying from 16 to 20 pounds per man, as well as a diarrhea epidemic. Leckie would say the John Erickson was little better than an African slaver that stank like a floating head. The only ones left healthy were the ones who had refused to eat the horrid food, subsisting only on peanuts and Pepsi-Cola. The 13,000-ton Macaulay was rated for 17 knots, which by transport standards is practically light speed. But she also had an intermittently flaming stack, visible for miles around, as we charged along for all the world like a horse-drawn steam fire engine. The fire-breathing smokestack, which was dangerous inasmuch as it could act as a beacon at night for interested and not necessarily friendly parties, had been troublesome for the last 18 months, but no one had gotten around to fixing it yet. This was largely because the Macaulay had a completely dysfunctional command staff. Her skipper was Captain Charles P. McFetters, whom Lieutenant Commander Twining of the 1st Marine Division described as a superannuated hypochondriac who was in no physical condition to command a ship. The deficiencies of a skipper can be addressed by a good executive officer, but the Macaulay's was Lieutenant Commander George K.G. Riley, a Marine-hating Mustang, a sadist determined to haze Marines, who worked to abuse them 24 hours a day. A bit more gentle than Twining, Admiral Turner's biography said of them, "These two officers struggled constantly to meet the demanding requirements of a stern taskmaster and an eager beaver staff, but never quite made the grade." The problems did not end there. The two most critical elements in any military operation are information and communications. And in communications, the Macaulay was sorely deficient, lacking even a voice radio. A radio suite was brought in, including 16 field radios, but the range of the radio was not much more than 5 miles, and still could not regularly monitor the frequency used by Admiral Fletcher. It was a common problem on the Macaulay. Of Admiral Turner's staff, only the meteorologist filed a satisfactory report on the particular flagship facilities needed for his efficient functioning. In the judgment of Lieutenant Colonel Twining, the Macaulay was a hell ship that was definitely not battle-worthy. Twining's opinion was prevalent among the Marines. General Vandegrift was so disgusted by conditions on board the Macaulay that he requested a vessel better suited in communications and accommodations, but had been denied. Only the exigent circumstances can explain why the Macaulay was chosen as the flagship for the first U.S. offensive of the Pacific War, and the first U.S. amphibious invasion since 1898. Admiral McCain deployed his Task Force 63 for primarily reconnaissance and anti-submarine patrols. He had at his command the Army Air Force's 11th Bombardment Group, consisting of the 26th, 42nd, 98th, and 431st Bombardment Squadrons, newly formed in July as a sort of mobile firefighting force under the direct command of the Joint Chiefs. The brand-new airstrip at Espiritu Santo had five Boeing B-17 flying fortresses of the 98th, five of the 26th were at Efate, 10 of the 42nd were split between two airfields on New Caledonia, and the 12 of the 431st were used as a kind of reserve and based at Nandi in the Fijis. Also on hand were 28 consolidated PBY-5 Catalina flying boats. Of these Catalinas, 12 are based on shore, 6 at Nandi in the Fijis, 4 at Efate, and 2 in New Caledonia. The remainder were on seaplane tenders, to be positioned for the flying boats to conduct air searches. The seaplane tenders, Curtis and McFarland, were moved up to Segan Channel, just off Espiritu Santo, from where the Curtis would deploy her 10 PBY Catalina flying boats to search south and southeast of the Solomons. The McFarland would continue on to the Santa Cruz Islands, so its 6 PBYs could search north and northeast of Guadalcanal. The seaplane tender Mackinac would be positioned in the Maramasique estuary on the east coast of Malaita to serve as a base for 9 Catalinas, whose primary job is to search to the northeast. Task Force 63 could also call on 79 Bell P-39-era Cobras of the Army Air Force's 67th, 68th, and 70th Fighter Squadrons, and 22 Martin B-26 Marauders of the Army Air Force's 69th and 70th Bombardment Squadrons. The B-26 was the closest American equivalent to the Japanese Naval Air Force's Mitsubishi G-3M Type 96 land attack plane, the Allies would call it the NEL, and G-4M Betty bombers, inasmuch as it could carry torpedoes. There were also 50 Grumman F-4F Wildcats of Marine Fighting 111 and 212 and Observation 251, 12 Hudsons of the Royal New Zealand Air Force, 25 Navy Vought OS-2U Kingfisher floatplanes, and 17 Curtis SBC Helldivers of Marine Observation 151. Given the area Task Force 63 had to cover, and the bases it had to protect, this was a woefully inadequate force in both numbers and type of aircraft. It was just the best that could be done. Even so, the most forward base, the new airfield at Espiritu Santo, had exactly 3 fighters in addition to its 5 B-17s, one of which crashed at sea on August 6th and had to be replaced from Efate, and 3 floatplanes. With the Bismarcks and the northwestern part of the Solomons still under General MacArthur's jurisdiction, his cooperation was required for Watchtower to succeed. MacArthur was indeed a good soldier, and amenable to working with Admiral McCain to coordinate search efforts within the Southwest Pacific Command area. The most important aspects of the agreement included the arrangement, from 5 days before the invasion to 4 days afterwards, of 4 daily reconnaissance flights from Port Moresby covering an area including Madang, Kavieng, Ondong, Java, Santa Isabel, and the Central Solomons. Naval targets discovered in this area within a 550-mile range of Port Moresby would be attacked in separate airstrikes. On the day of the invasion, and for 4 days thereafter, MacArthur's Air Force was to suppress Japanese air operations in and around Rabaul and Kavieng. In the meantime, 1st Marine Division Intelligence Officer Colonel Getke was still trying to dredge up anything he could on Guadalcanal and Tulagi, and not having much success. The Marines had no maps of the area, and their charts were inaccurate, so they decided to make a map from aerial photographs. Demonstrating a commendable degree of foresight, Admiral Gormley, who had been instrumental in setting up a U.S. Navy aerial photography unit, was able to take one with him when he was sent to the South Pacific. Gormley had an aerial photograph collage made of the Lunga area, but the weather during the mission had been cloudy, so there were blank spaces in the picture. General MacArthur's intelligence people promised aerial photography of the objectives. They put together a good set of photographs of the Lunga area, then sent it to the wrong address. General Vandegrift never received it. Lieutenant Colonel Twining was familiar with the criteria for a good landing beach, so he volunteered to personally perform an aerial photographic reconnaissance of the beaches. He went to Auckland to talk to Admiral Gormley, who told him he needed to take a plane from Noumea, so the Marine went to Noumea, where Admiral McCain told him his aircraft could not scout the Solomons due to a lack of range. The Army Air Forces could, McCain said, but wouldn't, as the local Army Air Force commander would not allow it. But McCain had a friend commanding the Army Air Force in Port Moresby who would arrange it. Twining would have to go there. As the Marine headed out, he was stopped in his tracks. "What do you know about aerial reconnaissance anyway?" the Admiral was asking. Before Twining could reply, McCain said, "Well, you got to go anyway, even if they burn you up. Good luck." With that last bit of encouragement, Lieutenant Colonel Twining and his crew made their way to Port Moresby, where Admiral McCain's friend had indeed arranged for a specially modified B-17 to take him over Guadalcanal and Tulagi to scout the area. Their fortress took off on the morning of July 17th, headed for Guadalcanal, their only map a reprint of a pre-war National Geographic with a map showing the Solomon Islands, which was just as good because the navigator was too engrossed in a comic book to pay much attention to it. They arrived in the Guadalcanal area around 2 p.m. The fortress headed toward Tulagi first, due to reports of enemy aircraft. Flying low to take photographs, they found Tulagi ringed with coral. Landings could only be accomplished with light craft. They also found float planes. The Nakajima A6M2N Navy Type 2 Interceptor Fighter Bomber, which did not exactly roll off the tongue, so, as they did with all other Japanese aircraft, the Allies identified it with a common given name, Roof. The Roof was literally a Japanese Zero with floats, and the roofs were taking off. Twining's Flying Fortress made a quick run over Lunga on Guadalcanal. The beaches looked good. There was indeed a runway there, or more accurately, most of one, with a big gap in the center that would not be there much longer. Before the fortress could make another pass, the float Zeros were onto it, holing the Boeing with 20mm gunfire and forcing it into evasive maneuvers before it escaped into a cloud. The B-17 managed to get away, but the exchange had caused it to use most of its fuel, and it still had to get back to Port Moresby. On top of that, they were lost. They managed to grope their way in the dark toward Papua, where bursts of anti-aircraft fire and searchlights in Port Moresby led them back to base. On fumes. But Lieutenant Colonel Twining got what he needed. On July 21st, Admiral Fletcher ordered all units to rendezvous southeast of the Fiji Islands at 2 p.m. on July 26th. The 12 transports and cargo ships of the amphibious force, carrying the 1st and 5th Regiments of the 1st Marine Division and their 14 escorts under Admiral Turner, sailed from Wellington on July 22nd. The 2nd Marine Regiment, coming from San Diego, was being escorted by the WASP Task Force. The 1st Marine Raider Battalion was to be carried by the destroyer transports Colquhoun, Little, McKean, and Gregory that were currently with the Saratoga Task Force. All in all, 72 of the 76 U.S. Navy ships arrived on time. Once assembled, they all headed for the Fijis to perform a dress rehearsal of the landing. With the rendezvous completed, on July 26th, Admiral Fletcher called the various commanders involved in Watchtower to his flagship Saratoga for a conference. It was to be a large conference. Admiral Turner's flagship Macaulay alone sent 17 officers, and one that would become infamous and somewhat bizarre. The bizarre nature of the conference stemmed from the absence of the man who should have been its dominant participant, Vice Admiral Gormley. This was the first major operation in his new area of command, and he was not going to attend the final meeting to iron out details and disputes. Gormley would later explain, "I was desirous of attending this conference, but found it impossible to give the time necessary for travel with possible attendant delays." Though his headquarters was in the process of moving from Auckland to Noumea, Gormley never gave an adequate explanation for his absence. In fact, though he had ordered the conference held, he had never planned to attend, and apparently only sent his chief of staff, Admiral Callaghan, along with his communications officer, at the insistence of Admiral Fletcher. The absence of the admiral from the conference had a definite effect. The destroyer hull arrived at the Saratoga, carrying the aforementioned Admiral Callaghan, the head of land-based air, Admiral McCain, and members of their attendant staff. En route, the destroyer had also picked up Admiral Turner and General Vandegrift and their staffs. When they arrived, they all got into a cutter, but the carrier rolled, and McCain ended up waist-deep in the ocean. Protocol required the senior officer to board first, in this case McCain. He stepped on the ladder, known as a Jacob's ladder, to climb aboard the flagship. As he was climbing, someone opened a garbage chute along the side and inadvertently dumped a torrent of sour milk.